Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. The Midday Book Club has been such a pleasure to be a part of. Anyone, of course, is welcome to read along. You can find a list of all the books online. Today, we're going to keep the conversation going with author Denise Turner. She teaches at Black Hills State University. The book is a memoir called Worthy. It explores themes of self-worth, fractured faith, shame, and more. I hope you enjoyed reading it as much as I did. I caught up with Denise Turner yesterday. Here is our conversation. First, I want to start out about talking about writing and the challenges of allowing yourself to become a character in a book. How did you approach just telling your story versus allowing yourself to become a character that people could relate to and care about and keep turning pages for?
Oh, well, I'm glad that you know the distinction between the person you are and the character on the page, you know, because that really is, you really are kind of a fabrication on the page. You're trying to fashion yourself into something that will be meaningful to other people. And so the process of that was painstaking. This book actually took 8 years to write. And the person in the book changed a lot in that time. You might have heard the voice change from, there's a pretty angry young woman there at the first and a less angry one later. And I was hoping that that was not only a real and personal transition, but it was also something that I hope that people could relate to, that when, you know, we all suffer grief of one sort or another, and we make these painful transitions. And so I wanted that to come out in that character who is also me.
Did you find challenges to, you know, saying things like when you have a temper tantrum or you're, you know, being kind of sullen about something? Did you have a hard time admitting that and looking at it, you know, as you reread what you had written?
Oh, that's a great question too. One of the challenges I had was the inability to express emotion well, because culturally, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, strong emotions are really discouraged for me growing up. And so I wrote this whole book, like my first version for my agent. She would give me these like really sort of angry comments in the margins. She's like, what are you feeling? And I'm like, she's like, you can't be numb the whole book. And I'm like, I am feeling a great deal. So one of the things I had to learn was how to actually, not just say I'm really mad here, but show what that looks like and try to explain what that feels like. You know, that there's that scene where I'm at the end where I visit my mother's grave with a big angel on it. And to try to put an emotion like that into words, that was probably the biggest challenge, because I had been so good at being, well, you feel things, but how do you describe those? That was the hardest thing.
And you
was to try to show that.
And reliving or re-experiencing some of those emotions then as you tried to describe them, I'm guessing.
Right. And I found that to be simultaneously hard and also healing, because when you're revisiting an experience, you get this flood of emotion, but you also have the opportunity to say, okay, well, what does it mean that I'm reacting that big? You can also, you have a little bit of distance for your rational brain to say, well, you know, why does that feel so big?
Sure. The book begins with the autopsy of your mother. Your mother has died in a fire. There are many questions that surround how the fire happened or what her physical state was, what her state of mind was when the fire happened. The book ends with returns to the autopsy, toxicology reports, things like that. So everything else becomes sort of bookended by your mother's body. And at some point in the book, you say, my mother's body, the history of her life is really the story of her body. Can you elaborate a little bit on why her physical form is so important to your understanding of her?
Oh, wow. I think, there's a lot of things I want to say here. I think partially the answer lies in our bodies were so much our identity. And I think that, a lot of women in particular can relate to that, that how you look and how you're physically attractive and all of those things, you know, we make so many judgments about a person based on their physicality. But I also get this feeling that, you know, we divide the body up into all these ways, that we have our emotional well-being and we have our physical well-being, and somehow those are different worlds. and our spiritual well-being, and that exists somewhere else. And so, you know, the first version of this book was actually called Principles of Internal Medicine, which made my agent gag a little. and my one of the things I wanted to say was that our bodies and our stories aren't separate things, that we house our stories. Our bodies are the side of our stories, and our scars and our, you know, and all of the things that we are. And so I wanted to speak to that this idea that our physical and well-being aren't different things.
Let's talk about your church, because I think we need to, your faith tradition, I think we need to bring that into the conversation fairly early. What were some of those early messages you received as a child or a young teenager about motherhood and how your church viewed mothers?
Motherhood. It was the only thing. It was, you know, when you grow up, you will be, your greatest calling in life will be that of being a mother. And certainly that's been a very beautiful thing for me. But it was really the only expectation, was this idea that you grew up, and everything you did was preparing you for your life's work as a wife and a mother. And so that's, you know, where my mother both, you know, believed in that and disrupted it so much by going back to school. So I saw her as just this terribly dangerous woman, while at the same time really admiring her for that and really wanting to be her. So I felt this really early conflict between who my mother was and who my faith, you know, my faith tradition as a kid growing up LDS or Mormon. Knowing that really the only thing I was supposed to be was a wife and a mother, and that was good enough.
And she wasn't just going back to school. She worked, right, as a physician assistant. Is that right?
Right. She went back to school while I was in grade school. And so, you know, I saw very early on a model of somebody who was working really hard and pounding out papers. And so when she finished, she wasn't about to let, you know, her schooling go to waste. And so she was a full-time career woman until she absolutely couldn't work anymore, until her body, you know, just started self-destructing and she couldn't. So I really had this model of a professional woman all of my life.
And she carried some guilt about that too, though, right?
I wish I knew. I think she did. You know, she wouldn't have let you know it because she was so proud, but it was almost like she was, that pride was partly defending her choices. Yeah, it was interesting. I don't know the answer to that.
You spent a lot of time with, over, if it took 8 years, over the character of your mother and over your memories of her and papers and journals that she wrote. How did she evolve for you personally throughout the process of writing about her?
Ooh, that's nice. She evolved a lot. I think that I was filtering, when she died, I was filtering all of my memories of her through, my mother doesn't love me because she's too busy. My mother doesn't love me. And so I was only letting those memories trickle in that substantiated that. And so by reading her journals and seeing, oh my goodness, she was this vibrant person. There was a time I was really, really loved. I was able to let other memories filter in. And actually that's part of the work of the book for me personally, was seeing that, you know, it wasn't that she didn't love me. She was loving me insofar as she could. She was giving me as much attention as she could, given her own compromised body, given her own compromised mental health. And so she fleshed out as a woman to me. She became more vibrant and complex and loving. And that's really the gift that I guess I gave myself in writing the book.
But she made choices about where that attention was going, and you didn't seem to have a problem with the choices she made about work, but the choices she made about her family were more difficult for you to wrestle with. Explain to me this notion of being so entrenched in, you know, her brothers and sisters and her father and their, is it a business? I don't know if you call it a business. It's the, what do you call it in the book?
That's it's simultaneously the partnership, because it's a legal designation,
right,
and something they called, you know, informally as the outfit, which
right.
was, you know, the sheet business. But, you know, I was always proud of her work as a professional woman. But the older she got, and and after her father died in particular, and her brother killed himself. She launched herself into family affairs in ways that just absolutely baffled me. Like, every bit of her attention was going to go to that part of her father's estate that she felt like she had earned and she deserved. And I wonder, you know, it was every waking minute. She was fighting with her brothers and sisters about who got what and you know, the old homestead property. And I really... The only way I could explain that was that piece of that her father's legacy had so much to do with her own worth. Like, if she was granted, you know, one of his sheep camps, or one of his, you know, saddlebags or whatever, or a bolo tie, that just had supreme symbolic meaning to her, so much bigger than the items, you know, themselves. And so I just wonder, you know, I never got to the bottom of what was behind that, but that was what bothered me most, was the energy that she threw herself into that.
And it made her sick, possibly. There was possibly, the stress of it possibly added to her physical demise.
Well, that's what she says, you know, to me in one of the scenes in the book, and I remember that actually clearly in real life, where, you know, she gets this terrible, terrible letter from someone in her family that's anonymous, and it just tears her apart about what a terrible person she is, and she's selfish, and I watch her reading this, and I can just see her energy drained, and she's so depleted and so depressed, and she just looks at me and she said, "I gave my help for the partnership," and it was just. It just, you know, socked me right in the heart. I was like, really, Mom? All the things you can give your life and energy to, and you gave it to this legal entity, like these people who don't love you, who don't care. So that's one of the great conflicts in the book for me, is that I cannot understand why she's so invested in this family that doesn't love her, as far as I can tell.
How did you come to deal with your own anger towards some of those things and towards some of those members of your family? Did you do that before you wrote the book, or was writing the book part of that healing process for you to get really mad about some of the things that were said and done?
Part of it was just being able to admit that I was angry and to see it in print and say, you know, There's reasons for feeling angry. Like, this is not normal. This is not how loving people treat each other. This is not worth it. So that helped me, like, just looking at the words on the page and also kind of standing up to this family that was so much larger than life. And I think they were larger than life to me because they were larger than life to her. But when you really, like, if you met these people, you'd be like, oh, what a bunch of lovely people who herd sheep. You would never feel like all the symbolic baggage that goes along with what we attach to people. You know, there's the physical human being, and then there's the emotional weight that person takes up in between our ears, I guess I want to say.
Yeah. When you're going through your mother's things, your father and you and your family members are sort of sorting through this massive collection of everything from jewelry to clothing, the way you handle those objects and the stories that they tell is so significant to me. And she had so much stuff, it would be easy to look at it as insignificant, but you found significance in many individual objects. Can you think of something that your mother owned that you want to talk about and how it really stood for more than just what it was as an item that you would find at an auction?
Oh, wow. That is such a great question. And I'm looking around at the very few things I kept, because I really did keep so few things of hers, because I was so, you know, angry. I'm like, I will not take any of this stuff, because she was pathological and mentally ill, and by taking this, I condone that or something. I think one of the things that that I have of hers that I cherish right now is one of her stethoscopes. And I've got it in a shadow box my sister put together for me, and it's kind of this crazy like teal color, and you can see that it's smoked from the fire, and but it's really beautiful to me because it reminds me that you know, part of the reason I'm the woman that I am today, that I was able to not only get a bachelor's but dare myself to go back and get a master's and even a doctorate, which I didn't even know existed as a child, was that she didn't behave herself. That she looked at her brother George and said, he went to school, and you know what, that's a thing I can do. And so by doing that, she showed me that, you know, women were more than mothers, and not that motherhood isn't wonderful, it is, but that she could be a mother in the community, and that she could be a professional, and that she valued her brain, and that was part of herself that I admire. And so I guess I would tell you that stethoscope means a great deal to me.
Let's talk a little bit more about motherhood, and because that's a theme that just obviously because you're talking often in this book about your mother, but also about yourself as a mother. And you talk about the model. I'm just going to read a little bit from page 149. The model I got from the church was being not good but flawless. There was no room for error, no second chance. Your children were your one true calling in life, and if they ended up depressed or confused or angry or broken, it was all your fault. And I'm wondering, is that the sort of thing that you really ever walk away from, or do you still carry it and try to balance being a good mother and keep it in perspective?
You know, I still feel that deeply. And my children now are 24 and 26. They're grown people. And yet every time they struggle, and I don't know if this is just being a mother in general, I'm like, well, you know, there's something I didn't prepare them to do. There's, you know, I really, really still want to jump in and fix things and be the mom. But I do, I still wrestle with this. Was I a good enough parent? Did my kids know that I love them? Because, you know, one of the things I did like my mother is I threw myself into my professional work. I found a lot of satisfaction in that. And so, you know, my kids had a lot of time on their hands while I was writing papers and going to graduate school. And, you know, I hope they know that I love them, because that's something that still troubles me. You know, did I love them enough? Did I give them enough support? I mean, they seem happy, but there I am alone in my office going, well, you know, I don't know. They're happy now, but they'd be happier. I don't know.
I think it's everyone. I really do. I really think it's a theme of parenthood altogether, but maybe uniquely motherhood that you personally.
That makes me feel a little better.
There are many times in this book where I've had the same feeling, Denise. I thought, oh, that makes me feel better, because even though I have a different backstory than you, there were times where, you know, you deal with these issues of worthiness so effectively that I think anyone can relate. And it's such a compelling personal story, but it's also truly universal. And I'm wondering if that was intentional, or did you just tell your story and let it breathe on its own? Or were you cognizant of having a reader someday when you were doing your writing?
I really wanted to have a reader right early on, because, you know, I've been studying this life writing. I've been in my PhD, and I was writing a dissertation, which would become a book about how autobiography in America works. And I'd studied how writing was a healing mechanism. And I'd done all this intellectual work. And then when my mother died, I was just finishing up all that intellectual work. And I thought, you know, you've studied this stuff, you know, can you do this? Like, if you wrote this for an audience, you know, what would your messages be, and what would you want to tell people? And that kind of collided with, well, I need to figure out what this means for me first before I can share that message. So I was constantly kind of feeling that I wanted to tell the story to a wider audience while sort of wrestling with, well, you know, don't you let this go out the gate until it's really, really the theme, your own themes, but you're not, because one of the things you can do as a writer or an author is get derailed. You're like, well, you know, what do people need to know?
Right. You end paragraphs very well. There's very often where I'm underlining at the end of a paragraph, there's these thoughts or these lines that you just almost can't move on to the next paragraph because they're so compelling. And then there are so many different stories really seamlessly knit together in the book, I think. And so my question is, how did you access and organize your memories of your mother? It's not all chronological, of your own story. How did you access and organize those memories to make this cohesive narrative that's really a page turner?
Well, the first thing you have to do is make a lot of mistakes and make some really, really terrible decisions.
Good to know.
Anybody out there who wants to write a book know that it's going to seem like a whole bunch of, like, Monopoly pieces and Scrabble pieces all thrown in a drawer together. And so one of the things that that I did was just keep lots and lots and lots of information in different files. I have, you know, over the 8 years that I wrote the book, you know, it looks like it's tidily handled in a year or two, but over the 8 years that I wrote that book, I had endless files and endless pieces, and I would go into my husband's office, and he had a giant whiteboard where his programmers would, like, come up with ideas, and I just with the colored markers going, I don't know where this fits. And so it's really a story of fits and starts, because it did not work seamlessly for a long time. It was messy. I had different voices going on depending at one part of the healing process I was going through. So it really had to do with finally discovering that thematic through line and throwing an awful lot of stuff out. That's the hardest thing to do as a writer. You're like, well, I spent days on that paragraph and it doesn't work. So
does it feel like throwing out part of your messy own story too? Is it harder to throw it out because it might be an actual memory that's important to you and that happened? Does that make it more challenging?
I think so. And I think that we get attached to our own words, because I'm like, well, that was really pretty. I don't want to throw that out. I spent a lot of time hammering out that, you know, those parallel constructions and that lovely sentence. And so I think as a writer, a harder thing to do is, and this is an Annie Dillard thing, is to realize when you need to ditch something and to just do the hard work of saying, as lovely as that paragraph is, it must go.